The National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History, Part 2. Eleanor Cohen and Rose Grossman are interviewing Mr. Julian Russlander for the second part of our interview on Wednesday, October 26, 1977. Mr. Russlander, we'd like to begin this interview with talking about you and your early life.
Since our last session, I celebrated my 61st birthday on October 23rd. And responding to a question that my father used to pose, is what life worth living? I can only say that I think that it is. And on balance, I've been a very fortunate individual, having had, by all measures, a happy childhood, a reasonably easy adolescent development, and with the usual trials and tribulations that anyone can expect in a lifetime. But responding more specifically to your questions about my early life, of course my immediate recollections are those of the fun we had as a family, my mother, my father, my brother, and myself. We lived from the time I was born until 1928 at 311 Melwood Street in the Oakland section. It's a street that today ran off of Center Avenue. And is, of course, a district that has undergone some change. When my parents first moved to Melwood Street, there were tennis courts across from the apartment in which they lived. Such things have long since gone in favor of commercial developments and commercial buildings. When my parents moved from West Park to Melwood Street, they lived in an apartment, and then later bought a house, and I think I told you before that for a long period of time they lived next door to Mr. Main. Mm-hmm. We moved from Melwood Street to Murdoch Farms, 5301 Fair Oak Street, when I was in Taylor Alderdice High School, and that was our family home until my father died in 1976. You ask about recollections of childhood. My father, as I remarked, was president of the temple, and my mother was not particularly a temple goer. We had emphasis on Jewish education, despite the fact that my mother, by her training, had quite a different background. One interesting story about my mother. Her father did not believe in organized religion. He felt, however, that his children should have a Jewish education, and so he hired a tutor to teach my mother and her brother Jewish history. But as mother said, her history, knowledge of history was a little sparse because the tutor was invariably late, and when he was late, she and her brother hid, and that cut off the sessions. But my father would go to temple and fast on the high holiday on Yom Kippur, and my mother would stay home and eat the best meals that she thought she could afford for herself, or put together for herself on that particular occasion. But notwithstanding the divergence of their approach to organized religion, they both stimulated, or tried to stimulate, in their children a sense of idealism, if not necessarily couched in a religious background. But we celebrated all of the Jewish holidays, and we really had the best of both worlds, because my mother always put up a Christmas tree, which I thought was very good in the home of the president of the temple. But she did it with tongue in cheek, and there was no malice in what she did. It was all because she had really a zest for living, and in many ways was a very remarkable woman.
What effect did this divergence of attitude toward religion have on the children? What direction did the children take?
Well, I would think you could literally call the children high holiday Jews. But as time passed, temple appearances get a little more frequent when you observe the anniversary of the death of your parents and other members of your family. But intensely religious, I am not, nor was my brother. I, of course, had a cousin who was a very prominent rabbi in Dayton, Ohio, Rabbi Selwyn Russlander, who achieved marked success in his career. He graduated from the Hebrew University College.
What's his first name?
Selwyn. And when I went to his funeral in Dayton, it was the largest funeral I've ever attended. There were over 200 cars in the funeral entourage with the military and the government, state, federal, and local all represented at his funeral. He had endeared himself to the community and had made quite a contribution to the community. So that I could say that the religion in our family was all centered in my cousin, the rabbi, and not in the younger Russlanders of Pittsburgh.
Tell us some more about your home atmosphere during your high school years, perhaps.
It's hard to be specific about anything. It was a relaxed and easy life. The demands made on the children were not those from a power on high. They seemed to be able to evolve them very naturally. And we just had a good time growing up together.
Would you consider your parents disciplinarians? Did they expect a great deal, did you feel, from their children?
No, I would say they led by indirection more than by direction, and believe me, it wasn't laissez-faire. They let you know when what you'd done wasn't exactly satisfactory to them. But they held up goals for us without pushing us. They were always pleased with academic progress and athletic progress, even though none of us were athletes. The athlete in the family was my mother. She had better developed kinesthetic senses than her children did. But we took trips together as a family, doing the things that families did and will do, and
hopefully
just let life go on.
Let's talk about your education.
Well, my education represents another one of the facets of my mother's personality. We went first to a progressive education school called the School of Childhood, which today is the Falk School. And as a matter of fact, my father was one of the incorporators of that school.
How old were you when you went to, you know?
Yes, mother didn't believe in sending you off at to pre-kindergarten or anything like that. I think I was 7 when I first went to school. But the most lasting impression I have of my schooling was the fact that I never learned to write. We were taught to print, and the best I can do today is scrawl a signature, and hopefully my printing is good enough that the secretaries can read it. But it was a good education as far as elementary school, because they did take you off into what were untried paths at that time, and if you had a responsive teacher, you got a lot out of it. I was sufficiently impressed with it that I ultimately had my own children go to the Falk School. I went to Taylor Alderdice when I was in 7th grade and graduated from Taylor Alderdice High School.
It's interesting that you didn't continue in the private schools, that you went from the private school to the public school.
I think at that stage of the game, my parents felt that they would prefer the public school setting to a private school setting. It was not at that time a matter of dollars because the Depression didn't come until later. I was lucky enough to win a scholarship to Pitt from Taylor Alderdice, which paid half of my tuition. And by that time, when I went to college, there was Depression, and it was very helpful to my parents that I had that scholarship, and that's why I went to school in Pittsburgh. I assume that they could have made some adjustments, but it worked out very well, and I've never regretted
it. Your graduate work?
When it came to going to law school, and I had long determined that I was interested in the law, my father had strong feelings that I should go to a Pennsylvania law school, which, of course, limited the choices. The emphasis was and still is on the bar exam, and he felt that you could get a good legal education at any of the Pennsylvania law schools, and that the emphasis on Pennsylvania law would be helpful. So that's what I elected to do, and I really preferred staying in Pittsburgh at that time and went to the University of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. Can you recall any teachers or any friends that made a particular impact on you during these years?
Well, I think it's been said by some of the outstanding people that if you're lucky enough to have one or two college professors that you really remember, or even including high school teachers, that you had more than your quota. And in that regard, I was strongly influenced by one high school teacher, a chemistry teacher, and by a professor of economics at the University of Pittsburgh, majored in economics as an undergraduate.
Do you recall the chemistry teacher's name?
Coburn.
And the teacher of economics?
Dixon.
Russell Dixon.
I don't know what happened to Mr. Coburn, but Dixon has since passed away. Dixon influenced me enough. I always thought I'd like to retire and become a professor of economics at some small college and live the relaxed life of a college professor.
It's a good thought.
Still appealing.
Yes, it sounds good. Mr. Dixon influenced many, many people in that way. Let's talk about health, your health, medical care, the services that were available to you. I'm sure they were unlimited.
I've been very fortunate. I've enjoyed substantially nothing but good health. Occasional thing that happens to people.
Very good. Can we talk about your marriage and your children?
I think my marriage to my first wife, Anita Oren, was very traumatic for my parents because we ran off and got married, and I was my first year in law school. But not only were my parents understanding, but the Oreners were too. And my wife and I and all four parents had a great relationship, which continues today, even with Mrs. Helen Oren, who's the sole survivor now.
You did tell us about your children last week, but perhaps we could just reiterate their names and where they're living.
The oldest is my daughter, Patricia Jane, who I went to Beth Sholem with my father-in-law, Abe Warner, and we named her Faga Esther, which was for the two grandmothers. But I'll never forget that occasion because it was the first time I ever saw older members of the community who could drink hard whiskey at 8 o'clock in the morning. I was a little surprised when my father-in-law took the cookies and the whiskey to Temple. It was a unique experience for me, but I admit that when I was allowed to open the ark and participate in the service, I found it very enjoyable and meaningful.
What was the Jewish name, Faga?
Esther.
Esther.
My daughter's the only one who was so named or given a Jewish name. Maybe that's why boys haven't become as religiously inclined as they might. Although my son Lee was born on Rosh Hashanah, which in the Jewish tradition, of course, is a great mitzvah. His father-in-law was very pleased with that. His grandfather, rather, Mr. Oren, was very pleased with that. And I was in the service at the time, so he was born when I was in the Philippines. And the interesting thing was a friend of mine from Pittsburgh, also in the Navy, was stationed in the Philippines, and he'd gotten word of the birth of my son from his family before I'd heard about it. And he located our ship, sent me a radio message, but with malice aforethought, congratulated me on the birth of a red-headed son. And all of my companions in the Navy knew that I was not redhead, and they knew my wife, and they knew she wasn't redhead, so they were all kidding me about what was going on while I was in the Navy.
If he told you whether it was a boy or a girl.
Yeah, oh yes, at least he gave me the benefit of a boy. And of course we named him after, really not after my father, but after my brother, who I told you before was a victim of the war.
When was Lee born?
Lee was born at least 32 hours ago. Lee was born in 1945, and then my youngest son, John, was born in 1948.
Okay. Your law career, you'd like to hear something about that.
Well, I indicated to you that I'd long felt that I would like to be a lawyer. The background at home, father sharing experiences that were the type that didn't involve confidentiality always intrigued me, and he would try to open our eyes to exploring many facets of a question not necessarily related to the law, but I'm talking now about the family around the dinner table or listening to Amos and Andy, which is what everyone did in those days. So that when I was in college, I used to go with my father occasionally when he would be trying cases. I went to New York. I carried his briefcase for him. And so I was long exposed to it. And knowing that my father was interested in taxes, I looked a little into accounting, because he always felt that if any lawyer who was going to be a business lawyer, not necessarily a tax lawyer, needed a knowledge of accounting. Though I told you I majored in economics in college, my minor was accounting, all with the idea of preparing myself ultimately for the law.
Then after you graduated from law school, did you immediately start to work in your father's
office? Yes, I went into the office with my father.
Well, let's go back to your service years. When did that take place?
That was after I graduated from law school in 1940. And as long as I'm talking about my father, I did not pass the bar exam the first time I took it, which was rather catastrophic in my mind. I was a married man, not making any money, and the inability to pass that critical test was literally more than traumatic. But if it was difficult for me, it also had to be difficult for my father, but he was most understanding. And I prepared more assiduously for the second exam. I like to say that though I failed the first time, I had made the second highest grade in the state on the second. But that's when I went into his office then and was admitted in 1941 rather than in 1940. And went into the service in 1943. And having a child, or being married and having a child, I was not the one who was on the top of the draft roll. But when the time came, I enlisted. Well, I got a commission in the Navy. Ended up as a small boat officer. My only recommendation for the Navy is I never got seasick and I sailed over 125,000 miles.
What was your rank when you left the Navy?
Lieutenant. I went in as a lieutenant junior grade and came out a lieutenant.
And you were in the Navy for how long?
I came out in January of 1946.
Did you want to make any further comment about your years in the Navy before we go back to your law? Or
yes, I was glad to get into uniform because at that time, you will recall, people didn't view the draft and military service the same as we have since Korea. And the minute you got into uniform, you felt more comfortable and you felt you were doing something that was right and that you should be doing. But as I say, I was a small boat officer, but when the war in the Pacific was over, someone told me that I should request duty ashore and request duty in Philadelphia. Well, I did, and the Navy exceeded to half my request. They took me off the ship, but they sent me to Tokyo, where I was a legal officer afloat for the Navy in Tokyo Bay. So when I got over there, I told the commanding officer I didn't know why they sent me. First of all, I only had 2 months more to serve before I'd be out. And secondly, I knew nothing about the law. Now, I was really only qualified as a small boat officer. But I really had fun for that month that I was actually over there, because I did a lot of sightseeing in Japan long before the rest of my fellow Americans.
You sure did. Bring back lovely things? Is that possible in those days?
We traded cigarettes for everything.
Oh, nice.
No cash, just cigarettes.
Yeah.
But I wasn't as discerning a buyer as I could have been.
And after the service years, you came back and you rejoined your father's law firm?
Came back and the firm...
That was in 1946.
And tried to make up for lost time. The only thing I regretted in the Navy was at the end, I was well aware of the gray market and I watched all these people, or I heard about all these people I knew who I didn't think were any smarter than I was, making himself a fortune dealing in the gray market and stealing. I figured he could have been at home practicing law and turning a few steel deals on the side. But that, I say that with tongue in cheek.
Yes. In your law?
When I came back and started to practice, of course, my major desire then was to pick up about 10 years actual experience in 1 year of living, because I knew I wasn't going to be able to trade on my father's reputation indefinitely. And sooner or later, I'd have to do it by myself. And the law is difficult only in one regard. It takes a long time to get the experience. And there's no substitute for the experience. But the Lord was good to me. I didn't have to do all that catching up. Father was around for a long time, much longer than one would have had reason to anticipate.
Was your emphasis also on tax law?
Yes.
Is the general office only for tax law?
Well, when I came back in 1946, it was my father had an office. Jerome B. Lieber was with him at that time, and there were two other lawyers. We practiced that way until 1965, having in the meantime become Russlander, Russlander, and Lieber, which of course is Jerome B. Lieber. And in the late 60s, Marvin Lieber was in the firm, another man who's with us now, Bernard Eisen. But Jerry Lieber and I, for several years, were thinking that the trend of the future would be that you'd have to have larger firms and the ability to specialize and the ability to attract lawyers in various fields. We had, in quotes, expertise, in quotes, in a relatively small area of business law, coupled with taxation. We knew nothing about labor. Could become a self-educated SEC lawyer, but the law was developing, and we had discussions with Alan Berkman and his associates, and then in 1965 it became Berkman, Russlander, Lieber, and Engel. And then in 1967 Mr. Pohl joined us. That's the way our firm is presently structured.